You know, there is a nice feature in Google when you can go from one point to another, and it takes you like flying over the world from one point. I love it. It's Google Earth. You should try it. It's very exciting, like to be in your room and to be able to fly in the world over the globe. And today we are going to do something like this, flying from here to the 9th, the 8th, the 9th, the 10th century. And we are going to end in a play that I would not recommend you to land these days because it's controlled by ISIS and some other not so nice people. So I think it's safer here in Canada. No place in the world is safe today, but this place in particular is not. And you know, before I'm going to tell you about Rabbi Saadia Gaon, really, the idea that I want to convey is how we watch history and the influence of history on the Jewish people. And I, you know, let's go back to the 9th century. I don't know what is your knowledge about the 9th century, but clearly there is something which is very, very different from today to this time. And this is, who is the hegemony in the world? Who is really controlling culturally, economically, scholarly, the world around us? And if today it's Europe and North America that no one knew about at this time, we are talking about a time where the Muslims were really where today is our best institution, like the Harvard of the day, the Yale of the day, the Cambridge of the day. They were all in Damascus, in Baghdad, and in the Muslim world. And the question is very, very simple. What happened? How is it possible that a culture who gave the world the math, algebra is basically al-jabar, which means the strong, the greatest science. So most of the algebra was developed by the Muslims. Of course, it enabled scientific and astronomical knowledge that was solely in the Muslim and the Jewish world, as we are going to see in a second. So what happened that over 1,000 years, the Muslim world became actually so paralyzed, such a degeneration of scholarship, of initiative, of technology, and instead it went to Europe. What happened here? Because this is important to understand, not only the time of Rabbi Saadia Gaon, it's very, very important to understand our times. What is the problem? Why the decay in the Muslim world happened, and what happened actually that the Muslim world in these 2-3 centuries became so prominent and so important? Any ideas? What happened? This is important because it's important to understand if we want to really change the situation of the world, this is very, very important to understand even today. And I would say in a very general way that we are talking about the time of spreading of Islam. Islam started in the 7th century by tribes who are starting to conquering from the peninsula of the Arab peninsula to the north, getting basically up to Spain, right? Spain became in less than 200 years a Muslim caliphate. And when the ISIS are talking today about the renewing of the caliphate, that's what they are talking about. They are dreaming about the situation in the 9th century and they want to be exactly the same, to control the world from everywhere that there was a strong Muslim presence, Spain, Europe, the Sham, El Sham, which is Lebanon, Israel, Jordan, and of course, the Saudi Arabia. This is a dream. But what happened to the dream? Well, Europe at this time was a very poor continent. Their contribution to the world was almost nothing. the most important contribution in the 9th century of Europe to the world were furs. Basically, had to do something with the way Canada started, at all kinds of posts of hunters and delivering the furs back to Europe. On the contrary, while spreading from the times of Muhammad and the Khalifs who replaced him, from the Lashon Khalifin in Hebrew, it's the same thing in Arabic, we have a strong spread towards Europe, people who are moving from one place to another. Think about this. Europe, the water are standing, the people are there. There is like a layer of people who have the lands, who have the wealth, and all the other people just serve them. No moving from one country to another. On the contrary, I want my field, I want my land, I want my palace, if it was the Atsilim, the feudals. While the Muslims are exposed to completely new cultures. They got to Syria and they found for the first time the writings of the Romans, of the philosophers. They are moving to Europe. They start to see other things that they never saw before. Movement, wealth, not in lands. The idea was cash. They had lots of money. They were exposed to new cultures, new art. And they also tried to convince the people where they came into touch to take some of their ideology and religion. In some places they did it through a scholarship. Sometimes they did it through the sword. But they were very, very successful. When you meet other cultures, you have to examine yours. You have to think about questions that people ask you. You have to think about new ideas that were introduced for the first time through the libraries by the scholars of the Greeks or the Latin language. And it was a time of flourishing because when two cultures are meeting each other, sometimes even if they clash with each other, they enrich each other. And that's exactly what happened. So we are talking about very exciting centuries to the Muslim world and to the Jews who are living there. This is the first time that they have to deal with some major question, philosophical question, that were erased and for the first time came to the ears of the Jewish community. The Jewish community at this time, the center, and with no doubt, the most important center for centuries is what is today Iraq, Babel of their time. The Talmud, which was more or less concealed in the year 500, was, with no question, the most important piece of literature, of Jewish literature. But here is the point. To us, the Talmud Bavli is obviously, when I'm telling you that this is the most important piece of literature, we already know it. But it was not the situation in the 6th or the 7th or the 8th century. Because at the same time, we have a very important Jewish center in Eretz Israel. Not a strong one, not a big one, but still in Eretz Israel and still holding the Masorot, the traditions from the previous centuries. Remember, we have a person like Rabbi Yochanan, who had a yeshiva in Tveria. He had students. They have students. Yes, they went to places like Caesarea of today, Rabbi Abahu, and Ula. They were even to places like Akko. Some of them arrived to the area of Lod, where there was the old Jewish center. But, and I'm sorry, before that, and you should know, that some of the minhagim in Eretz Israel were very different than Babel. And I will take something as important as kashrut. You know, today we have the glat and not glat. You know where it starts? It starts there, between the people of Babel and Eretz Israel. Is glat is a requirement or not? And the communities in Babel and Eretz Israel were in machloket about it. Now, this is something, you know, kashrut, when it comes to food, it must be very, very important. what some people consider to be perfectly kosher in Babel, the people of Eretz Israel did not want to eat from it. If it's not glut, they don't eat. So you see that the machloket of today and like what is glut and what is not, it's already like more than 1300 years ago. One example. So the Talmud Bavli, by the way, was very strong and accepted in the area of Babel, but everything to the west, not exactly. Many questions, many disagreements. If we are going towards Iran and east of Babel, the same problem. And over there, it's coupled not only by disagreement about the halacha, but the way the yeshivot of Babel, that I'm going to explain in a second, control these areas, it involved taxes. And you know what? For some reason, Jews don't like taxes. Once the yeshivot established certain taxes on the communities in order to maintain the rabbis, the meshamshim bekodesh, all the people who are serving the Jewish community, dayanim, courts, they tried to remove themselves from the system and the establishment, and they did not accept the Talmud Bavli as the last word, as the people of the Talmud Bavli, the Amoraim, and later the Svoraim, wanted it to be. And here we come to a time that is, most of the information that we have it from the Gniza Kairi, this shul in Cairo, that only in the 19th century they found hundreds of thousands of letters and sheilot u'tshuvot. And we know a little bit about the life of the Geonim, and the picture that I'm going to draw today is based on really the finding in this Gniza Kahiri, this treasure that they found in the Shul of Cairo, because the weather over there and the dry air, it actually stood in a perfect condition for hundreds and actually more than 1,000 years. The Geonim of Babel were especially in two centers, the yeshiva of Sura, the yeshiva of Nahar Dea. Now, when we talk about these two places, we have to remember, where did it start? The yeshiva of Sura was established by Rav, a student of Rabbi Yehuda Anasi. After writing the Mishnayot, he understood that there is no future to Torah in Eretz Israel. Most of the Jews, because the economy immigrated to Babel, to the area of Iraq, and he goes to establish a new Torah center in a place which is Sura, very, very close. When you hear today in the newspaper, in the news, the word Fallujah, a few miles away from Fallujah, we have the yeshiva of Sura. Another friend of him, Shmuel, is going to another yeshiva, the yeshiva of Nahar Dea. Later he changed the name to Pumbedita, and this became the two centers of the Jewish people, not only in Babel, where most of the population was, but basically in the entire world. The academies of Sura and Pumbedita, or Nahar Dea, established a reputation that drew students from all over the world. At the time it was Israel, Afghanistan, yes, there was a very ancient community there, Iran, and they all come to these two yeshivot, Sura and Nahar Dea. This lasts for seven generations, something around 200 or 250 years, and we come to the point where the Talmud is complete. Ravina and Rav Ashi in Sura and Nahar Dea, of course, they moved to some other places in between, but all of them were along the Butter Street of the Middle East, the Euphrates and the Tiger. The Jewish communities established themselves on these two major rivers because it enabled, obviously, trading, transport from one place to another. And in the beginning of the 6th century, the Talmud Bavli complete. But as I say, not with no challenges. And from here on, we start time of protecting the Talmud as the most important literature of the Jewish people. You had to protect it. And the Yeshivot and Sura and Nahardea continue to maintain the same traditions at the time of the Talmud. They did not add anything to the Talmud. They couldn't anymore because after the year 500 or so, it was complete. But now it was a time to protect it, which means it was a time to show that the Talmud Bavli is indeed such a important literature that must be the leader for generations to come. Who were the people who did it? The Gaonim. What is the name Gaon? In modern Hebrew, Gaon is a genius, but it's not. The term Gaon came from the name of the Yeshivot. The Yeshivot, after the time of the Talmud, and maybe even in the time of the Talmud, were named Yeshivot Gaon Yaakov. This was the name, Gaon Yaakov. Gaon Yaakov basically is Beit HaMikdash, and the name is very ambitious. It came to tell us that basically what replaced Beit HaMikdash after the destructions? The centers of Torah. And they were well structured. The Gaon, which was actually Kitzur of the Rosh Yeshiva of Gaon Yaakov, he became a Gaon. The second, which was Av Beit Adin, was Aluf. This is in the Yeshivot of Babel. By the way, the Gaon in Eretz Israel usually was called also the Nasi, although the Nesiut, as we know it from Rabbi Yehuda Nasi, Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel, was not exactly the same, but it was a remnant of the Nesiut, so they called the Gaon of the Yeshiva in Eretz Israel Gaon and Nasi. And listen, this takes about 500 years. And let me tell you one thing. You don't know many names of this Gaonim, and for a good reason. They did not make any special innovation. They did not initiate anything. And what they tried to do is one thing which was very, very important, as I said before, to protect the Talmud. If there was a question, they explained the Talmud. If there was a need to decide what is the halacha in a certain, in a particular case, based on the Talmud, they told you what is the halacha in the Talmud, because the Talmud, although complete, there was no clear system of what is the halacha in Shabbat, what is the halacha in some of the halachot of Eduyot and so on. So they also were pasken halacha. So let's try to see now a little bit the bigger picture. We have the Yeshivot of Babel, which are very traditional. They keep Masoret tradition of a few hundred years, while the world around them is changing, and changing fast. The Muslim world start with, for example, let's take an area like music, completely undeveloped in Europe at this time, but well developed in the Muslim world. Actually, the what we call today the Mizrahi or the Arab music is even more sophisticated than the European one. The makams, the structure of the music, it's more sophisticated, much more fine-tuned. I'm not going to explain it in musical terms, which I'm not a great expert, but I would say it's the beats are even more divided than in the modern style of music, which allow much more flexibility and accuracy of the music than even today what we have. It's here sometimes the real good Sephardic Chazanim. It's just amazing how they move from one, how do you say it, like the sulamot, the accords, the ladders from one octave to another. See, and how fast they go back and forth. This was all developed in the 8th century and the 9th century by the Muslims. Think about philosophy. You know, in the Jewish world, you did not talk too much philosophy. The rabbi gave his sermon on Shabbat, but major question, who is God? What are the dimensions of God? If he had any dimension, of course, now you say, Eino guf ve'eino dmuta guf. But this is a Rambam in the 10th and the 11th century. This is not the simple Jew of the 7th and the 8th and the 8th century. The authority of Torah Shebe'al Peh, of the Talmud Bavli, is it authentic? Is it really the word of God, yes or not? And in this time, they start to question it. I'll give you one example. In Afghanistan, in the city of Belch, not Belz, Belch, there is a scholar by the name Chivay, Chivay Abalki. Of course, he came from Belk or Belch, and he was named Chivay Abalki. This guy, for the first time, is writing a book with 200 questions about the Jewish belief. He was a Jew, but he started to make fun of all kinds of traditions, traditions that came through the Talmud Bavli, from the Chachmei HaTorah Shebe'al Peh, and he present 200 questions that the Jewish people started like they didn't know what to do with them. These were serious questions. Is it possible that all the miracles that are written in the Torah are indeed true? He did not agree with it, and it was the first time that major beliefs were challenged in the Jewish community. Never before questions like this came to the entire population of the Jewish community. As a comment, before I talk about Rav Seadia Gaon, I will tell you that Rav Seadia Gaon say that for 60 years, some of the teachers in the Jewish schools, which were the phenomenon in the world, they taught based on conclusion of Chivay HaBalki. So there was no response to this question, so people just took it, okay, apparently, you know, all the tradition that we had are not so true. And they started to teach upon the conclusion of Chivay HaBalki. Rav Seadia Gaon, in a twist, instead of calling him Chivay HaBalki, started to call him Chivay HaKalbi, which means like the kelev, the dog. So instead of Balki, just switch the middle letters and he started to call him Chivay HaKalbi. Of course, by doing that, he did not contribute anything, but he conveyed very clearly what he thinks about people like this who try to shake the emunah. But he knew that, okay, Chivay maybe is the first one, but now this kind of questions are going to come more and more through the Jewish community, and he was right. Because at this time, exactly, we have a new movement that almost shake the Jewish world completely. And what am I talking about? The Karaites. This is a time where the Karaites, the people who did not believe in the Perush of Torah Shebichtav, by the Torah Shebe'al Peh, who opposed the Talmud Bavli and the Mishnah, are starting to gain power. And you have to understand, this is very, very important. When you don't have other sources for your knowledge, if you are brainwashed with one way to understand things, you buy into it. The Jewish people are intelligent, but if no one is talking about this question, if no one is giving good answer to this question, at the end, the scholars of the Jewish people are going to be convinced that there is only one body of scholarship that they should listen to learn, and this was the Karaites. It's no wonder that in the 8th and the 9th century, the Karaites became so powerful. By the way, they sent their a long arm to Israel, to Spain, to Europe, because this was actually a hard work of scholarship. You have to understand, you cannot defeat Chachamim without providing proofs to your ideas. And they did. They started to publish books about their understanding and about understanding the Mikra. They started to develop a whole system how the Torah and the Tanakh explains themselves, something that was not exist in the rabbinic Jewry of the time. The dikduk, the grammar, the Hebrew grammar was controlled completely by the Karaites because the Mikra became the most important source to them, and they developed it very, very seriously along with the trend of the time. Because the Muslims had exactly the same problem. The Muslims got the Quran, and the Quran is hard to understand. At the end of the day, even if you are a Muslim, if you want to conduct your life upon the Quran, it's very, very hard to do. And therefore, many scholars in the areas where the Muslim concord, they started to explain the Quran. And there was like debates and questions. And at this time, the Muslims were very, very open. They actually wanted to ask questions. They wanted to know more. And this was very intriguing to the Jewish scholars. Here is a whole culture of asking questions, of debating, of philosophizing over major issues. It intrigued a lot to the Jewish community who, in response from the famous Yeshivot of Babel, they heard nothing. Because the people in the Yeshivot of Babel were interested only in one mission, to keep the Talmud, and they shut themselves down from all the influences of this time. This was the introduction to Rabbi Saadia Gaon. In Egypt, where there is a very small Jewish community, not to talk about like almost zero Jewish scholarship, there is one person by the name of Said, his Hebrew name is Saadia, who lives in the area of, it's called Payum. Payum is actually keeping the name of a city in the Torah, Pitom. Pitom Beramse, so Payum is like a mistranslation, or over time it changed from Pitom to Payum, not far away from Cairo. And to a very small family, there is a child, a boy, who apparently was extremely talented. The only teacher he had was his father. And we know nothing about the teachers of Rabbi Saadia Gaon. Very, very little. We don't know who he learned Torah from. Certainly we don't know how he learned Talmud. But the next fact will prove you that he was unusually, not only Gaon, as I said, the Rosh Yeshiva later, 40 years later, but he was also a genius. He decided, in the age of 18, to write his first book. His first book was a dictionary, but a very unique dictionary. It had 5,000 words in Hebrew, but he built it in two parts. One part was, the dictionary was according to the alphabet, the beginning of the word, like we have the traditional dictionaries of today. The other one was, I think that I saw something like this in English too, the end of the words. All the words that end with bat, Shabbat, Bavat, Yushbat, etc., etc., etc. So it was a whole, there is anything like this in English? No, there is no. And in the age of 20, he published this book. He started to write it, or maybe even to start taking his notes when he was young. But at the age of 20, he published the book that was named Agron. Any idea why a person should have like a dictionary with all the end of the word as like a reference point? To help with PUT. He was exposed to a new art that was not a Jewish one, a Muslim one, of beautiful songs that were structured in very accurate way. And he wanted to start develop something like this in the Jewish community. And in order to enable others, he did not want it only to himself, because he wrote some beautiful piyutim. None of them the Ashkenazi community have. Many of the Yemenite Jews are using his piyutim until this very day. But unfortunately, he was a Sephardi, so many of piyutim did not arrive to the Ashkenazi community. Although there is a twist there, maybe I'll have some time to talk about this one. And he wanted people to be able to find the right word, how to end every song, every stanza, every sentence of the song. So this was Sefer HaAgron, and we don't have enough time, but he writes, how could we leave the language that Malachi HaSharet are talking? How can we leave the language that the Torah was written? How can we leave the language that the Tanakh was written, and people today don't know Hebrew very well? I decided to change the course of history. That's what he writes. I want that every Jewish boy and girl will speak the Lashon of the Nevi'im. He was like, he had the love for the Hebrew language, but you see, many of us like many, many things. But he took his time and wrote a book. He did, was not waiting for others to do the job for him. And this is going to be like something that will repeat itself many, many times in the life of Rabbeinu Seadia Gaon, to take the initiative when no one else took this initiative before him. Well, this was quite an achievement, who gave him a free pass with the scholars of Eretz Israel. At the time, the scholars of Eretz Israel are concentrating in Tiberia, and they are the ones who develop the Teame HaMikra, the grammar of the Hebrew, because until then, in the Talmud, you will not find, I can assure you that, like discussions about the grammar of the Hebrew. Who cares? We have the Hebrew. We know creative. This is the maximum that Chachamim went, to analyze because it has halachic implications. But the grammar, in a systematic way, like the verb, the structure of the word, atid, avar, no one knew anything about it. And he took all the words in the Tanakh and started to develop a systematic way how to see the rules of the Hebrew language. When I talked about the twist I wanted to talk about, you know, Dror Ikra, you all know Dror Ikra for Shabbat? Okay. Baruch El Elyon. So these piyutim were written by his best student. His name is Dunash Ben Labrat. And eventually they made their way to Europe. That's why even the Ashkenazic people have at least the piyutim of the students of Rabbi Seadia Gaon. But you should know, he did not go with no struggle. Like some of the Baalei HaTosfot, when they got, even Rashi and his students got some of the songs, for example, Dror Ikra, they went ballistic, because they thought that they are twisting the Hebrew for the purpose of the piyutim. I'll give you one example, just one example. Dror Ikra leben imbat, ve'in tzorchem kemo bavat. Beautiful. And the whole song is really beautiful. Babat, ba'at, shushbat, shvun uchu beyom shabbat, etc., etc. But one of the students of Rashi said, wait a second. Dror Ikra leben imbat ve'in tzorchem kemo bavat. What is bavat? You know what is bavat? The pupil of the eye. But it's bavat is smichut, bavat ha'ayin. It's a pasuk in Yeshayahu that Hashem is going to keep Bnei Israel as bavat eino. So he said, bavat? Okay, you have a beautiful piyut, like which rhymes with Shabbat, but with all due respect, there is no word in Hebrew, bavat. If you want to say bavat, it has to be bavat ha'ayin. So you actually twist the Hebrew in order to make beautiful songs. And they went really like, they were furious about these ideas. And it came up to the time of Rabbeinu Tam that had to make shalom. But you can see like the kinah, how they were zealous about like the Hebrew and the proper use of Hebrew. Alvai that we are going to have it today, but this was the time. So some of the piyutim of the students of Rav Seadia Gaon, even the Ashkenazic have. Now, I want to say something very, very important. You see, you all know piyutim that were written before the time of Seadia Gaon, especially by Eliezer HaKalir. Eliezer HaKalir, many of his piyutim we say in Rosh Hashanah, many of his piyutim on Yom Kippur, in the Yotzrot, yesterday was Yotzer Parashat HaChodesh, and we said in the shul that they still say piyutim. We have one piyut of Rabbi Eliezer HaKalir, who was, we don't know exactly who he was, but certainly he was apparently at least the latest, he was in the 7th century, okay? So it was before, but Rav Seadia Gaon saw that this piyutim, the old piyutim, who were, by the way, only in Eretz Israel, not in Babel, are, how to say, very hard to understand. And everyone who say this piyutim on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur knows exactly what we are talking about. It's impossible to understand. It's a mixture of midrashic and biblical psukim and all kind of words that were invented for the beauty of the language. Now, they are incredible because some of the piyutim of Eliezer HaKalir takes the most beautiful Agadot Chazal and profoundly make a collage that give you a whole picture of Rosh Hashanah, but who can understand it? So Rav Saadia Gaon took the art of piyut, but made it very accessible even to simple Jews. Simple words, again, build in a very clear structure, 3-3-4, 3-3-4. And for example, sometimes it was 2-2-4-2, 2-2-4-2. This is not the time to explain about piyutim. But he made it very, very accessible. It was important for him. The Jews are not going to see these gatherings of the Muslims around them, and they sing beautifully, and they have such a rich piyutim that they had, and the Jews have nothing. By the way, in the yeshivot of Babel, piyutim were outside. They were considered like waste of time, something that was very suspicious. Why wasting your time on writing things like this when you can write halachot or participating in the discussion of Beit HaMidrash? Rav Saadia Gaon is the first one to bring this culture that was well developed in Eretz Israel and to bring it to Babel in the later century, in the 9th century. As I said, Rav Saadia Gaon is already recognized as Ilui, as a genius. He absorbed already the grammar and the Hebrew from his teachers in Tiberia. He's 23 years old and he arrives to the most important yeshiva in Babel, the yeshiva of Sura. This was the most important yeshiva at the time. The situation was that you have an academy with fantastic reputation, but in a slow process of decay. And the main reason was that the yeshiva of Sura and Naharda have a very rigid rule who can be at the helm of the yeshiva. It could be only one who grew up in this yeshiva. This was the rule, it's documented. Only people who learned in the yeshiva of Sura could become rabbis in the yeshiva of Sura. And for good reasons, I have to say, to us it looks, why? If he's smarter and know more. As I explained before, it was a time where tradition were created. And they were very concerned that, you know, they knew that in Pumbedita they have some other minhagim. Can you imagine today, like a misnaget come to a Hasidish shul and doesn't say part of Kaddish. You know, we say, "Itkadal v'kadash merabah, peolma divrach ruteh v'yamlich malchuteh, v'yatzmach purkaneh v'yikarev meshicheh." I'm telling you, if a chassid come and say, "V'yatzmach purkaneh v'yikarev meshicheh," in Ashkenazic shul, in some of them, he will be stoned on the spot. How can you say, "V'yatzmach purkaneh"? This is like our tradition for hundreds of years. We don't say, "V'yatzmach purkaneh." The same kind of important things in Babel, you could not go from a yeshiva of Sura to Naharda or Naharda to Sura because they had different minhagim about all kinds of things. I'll give you one example. In the yeshiva of Pumbedita, they say Kedusha every single day. In the yeshiva of Sura, only on Shabbat. Okay? This is a serious issue. They don't want someone to come from Pumbedita, as great as he is, to the yeshiva of Sura and to establish Kedusha every single day, when they believe that we can imitate the Malachim who are singing the Kedusha only on Shabbat. This is the only day that, you know, the Jewish people are uplifted like the angels themselves. Every day, crazy, ma pitom. But at the same time, when you limit yourself in a place like the high academy of Sura only to certain people, what happened when you don't have enough people? And you have this rule. So what you have is mediocrity. You just get the people who are not that good, but they belong to the right yeshiva. And usually, by the way, they were belong also to the right parents and family. Indeed, the yeshiva of Sura and Nahar, they are both of them, were controlled by six families. And all the geonim, for example, came from these particular families. You could not go inside. But as I said, the reputation of the yeshiva of Sura from the time of Rav, 300 years before, or 400 years later, or 500 years, was still there. But it was only reputation. It was only, you know, the yichus, but no substance. At this time, I must tell you about a competition to the whole world of the yeshiva that really controlled the Jewish life. And this is the famous institution of Rosh HaGola. How the Jews conducted their life in the Galut, especially in Bavel and the areas around. Even in the time of the Persians, before the Arabs took over, and especially in the time of the Arabs, there was an institution that was named Rosh HaGola. Usually he was from the family of the Nasi. They all were descendants of Hillel HaZaken, who was also belonged to David HaMelech and above to Yehuda. He from Ezra HaSofer. So they were family that kept the tradition of Beit David, even in the Galut. And they were the representatives of the people to the governments and of the governments to the people. They got permission to take taxes for the Jewish community, to deal in all kind of financial issues in the Jewish community, so they have a quite independent court system. And obviously the Rosh HaGalut was basically the king of the Jews. Not the same authority that, you know, the Nesi'im in Eretz Israel had or the kings had before, but there are descriptions, for example, when Rosh HaGalut went to visit the Khalif, the person that was in charge from the government, he usually went with 15 people. One was running before his horse, and every Jew who met them on the way joined the march. And sometimes they arrived to the vizier or to the caliph with like hundreds of Jews. This gave the Jews a great pride that they still have some sovereignty, even in the Galut. This happened until the 11th century when it, even the Rosh Galut decayed completely for reasons that we will not discuss today. And this was a very, very strong institution. Now, what happened here? Who appointed the Geonim in the Yeshivot? The Rosh Galut. Many, many times, who was involved in choosing the Rosh Galut? The Gaon of the Yeshiva, because he had lots of influence. He was a rabbi. He influenced the people in the community. So it was like an interest of each one to respect the other one, because you never knew how it's going to end. I would say in these days, it's always a tension between the rabbi and the board. It's the same thing. Basically, who runs the shul? So this is a very long story. Who runs the shul? Is it the rabbi? Is it the board? And Resh Galuta was the board of the Jewish people, kind of. And the Rosh Galut was actually more than just a board. It was like a person who runs the business of the Jewish community and the rabbi. The Rosh Galuta at the time, which his name was, I think, David Ben Zakkai. Ben Zakkai, I'm sure. David, I'm not sure. Was a very, very tough person. And he really wanted to save the yeshiva of Sura. The yeshiva of Sura was not what it used to be. Students did not come. The reputation was down. With the reputation down, what happened? What? More important?
Money.
money. There was no money in the yeshiva, you're right. And he understood that they must do something radical in order to save the yeshiva of Surah. And he actually had a candidate, Rabbi Saadia Gaon. Why Rabbi Saadia Gaon, who came from Egypt, no one knew about him until 10 years before. There was something that made Rabbi Saadia Gaon very famous in the entire world and maybe the leader of the rabbinic world of the time. And this is something that is very appropriate to talk about now when we are just before Rosh Chodesh Nisan. The year is 922. And you know that the month where used to be dictated, or Rosh Chodesh was dictated by Edim, by witnesses who saw the new moon. This was replaced after the destruction. We don't know exactly when, but we do know that around the time of the year 300 or 400 maximum, the system was replaced with astronomical calculations. The sages used to calculate the time of the Moladot, of the Rosh Chodesh, and to decide when Rosh Chodesh is going to happen. They had some rules, for example, the most famous one, Lo Adu Rosh, Rosh Hashanah, can never happen on Aleph, Daled, or Vav, in order to make sure that Shabbat is not going to be before or after Yom Kippur, or before and after Hoshana Rabbah, for reason that it's not the place to explain, and Lo Badu Pesach. Pesach will never fall on the days Bet, Daled, and Vav, for another reason. The reason is actually because we watch forward to Rosh Hashanah, and since the month can be or 29 or 30 days, in order to make sure that Rosh Hashanah is not going to fall on Aleph, Daled, Vav, you must already plan it ahead and not to make Pesach on Bet, Daled, and Vav. So now we don't see the Levana anymore. We based it on calculations. One of the rules of this calculation is called Molad Zaken. The law is that if the molad of the new moon happened after midday, you cannot declare this day, although the astronomical renewal of the cycle of the moon started today, Rosh Chodesh will be not announced today. It's going to be pushed for tomorrow. So if it happened, for example, at 11:30, let's assume that the day is exactly 12, what we have 12 is exactly midday. If it happened at 11:40, today will be Rosh Chodesh. If the new moon is going to be 11:50, Rosh Chodesh. 11:59, Rosh Chodesh. 12, tomorrow is going to be Rosh Chodesh. It's called Molad Zaken because it was like too old to appear in the sky. It appears after midday. This is a rule that is part of apparently what Moshe Rabbeinu got from Hashem when he gave him the mitzvah of Kiddush HaChodesh that we learned yesterday. The year 922, the Molad happened in the 12:03. 12:03. What should we do according to our rules to push Rosh Chodesh for tomorrow? Now, let me tell you something. There is a problem to push it to tomorrow, because if it's going to be instead of Sunday on Monday, then Pesach is going to happen on Monday. We cannot have Pesach on Monday, so we push Rosh Chodesh from Aleph to Tuesday. And sometimes you know that you can see even in Rosh Chodesh that the Yareach is already like pretty visible in the sky. And this was the situation in the year 922. But remember, I told you that there was still a community in Eretz Israel. And you know, according to the Mishnah and the Talmud, the only Beit Din which is qualified to decide upon the Jewish calendar, the Jewish holidays, is just the court in Eretz Israel. People in the Galut cannot do it. Unless, and this is very, very important, the major, the heavyweight scholarship of the Jewish community is outside the land of Israel. For example, there is a Mishnah that once Rabbi Akiva actually did a cheshbon or pushed one of the Rashei Chodashim in Bavel because Rabbi Akiva was considered as the expert. So although there was sages in Eretz Israel, scholars in Eretz Israel, because the most important scholar was in Babel, he did it. Saadia Gaon was not a Gaon yet. And he said, well, we just got a letter from Eretz Israel that they are not going to celebrate Rosh Chodesh and Pesach, therefore, on... Wait a second. Okay, so just to complete the story. So remember, 12 and 3 minutes is pushed for the next day. And since in the year 9222, it could not push to the next day, which was Monday, and therefore Leila Seder is going to happen on Monday. No. They had to push it with another day. They got a letter from Eretz Israel, from the Gaon of Eretz Israel. His name was Aharon Ben Meir, that said, wait a second. This is going to be Rosh Chodesh. Sunday is going to be Rosh Chodesh, and we are going to celebrate Pesach on Sunday, 2 weeks later. Because I have a tradition that when they say midnight, it's midnight plus 923 chalakim. You know what? There is so much discussion about this. It's another 13 minutes. He said, I have a tradition that when there is a Molad Zaken, it's not exactly midday. It's midday plus 13 minutes. Can you see the situation? The Molad happened at 12:03. According to the tradition of Eretz Israel, it's not really 12 o'clock. It can be pushed up to 12:13. But the tradition of Saadia Gaon and the Geonim of Babel was different. Midday is midday. 12:03 means the next day. If not possible the next day, 2 days later. And they send a letter when they heard about the cheshbon, the calculation for the next year. You are wrong. You know, if people will stick to your calculation, then the Jewish community is going to be divided. Like some people, we are going to tell them in Babel that they have to celebrate Pesach on Tuesday, you are going to celebrate it on Sunday. What a shame. It never happened in the Jewish community, anything like this. Well, obviously the debate was not about 13 minutes. It was who is the boss? Is it the community in Eretz Israel smaller than in Babel? Not as rich as in Babel, but in Eretz Israel? Or the boss is the community in Babel? This was the major question. Let me tell you something. In the year 922, they celebrated Pesach in two different times. It was this one and the 923, some communities still. They celebrated it according to the rule of Bnei Eretz Israel and the rule of Bnei Babel. Some people had Pesach from Sunday. Some people had Pesach on Tuesday. We know it, by the way, a little bit from the letter that were exchanged between Babel and Eretz Israel, but more, we know from a Christian scholar who lived in Damascus, and he said, it's unbelievable what happened this year. Some communities who lived in Damascus followed the rules of the people in Eretz Israel, and they started Pesach on Sunday. Some people started it on Tuesday. So who paid attention to this phenomenon? A Christian scholar in Syria. That's how we know that it indeed existed. It happened. Rav Saadia Gaon put all his power to make sure that they follow what he believed is the right calculation. And he won. He won with a lot of help from Rosh HaGalut, David Ben Zakkai, who thought that the calculation of Rav Saadia Gaon is more credible because the one in Eretz Israel was, we have a tradition. He could not prove it from the books. In the Talmud Bavli, it says, Molad Zaken Editiv. There is no like any perush plus 13 minutes. And the other one, we had a tradition. He said, this tradition comes from the Nesi'im of Eretz Israel of hundreds of years. But this was an opportunity for Saadia Gaon to show, no, we just follow now not all kind of traditions, secret traditions who are going in the family. We are following what the Talmud Bavli is telling us. And he won. In the year 924, even the people in Eretz Israel followed the Cheshbon of Rav Saadia Gaon, and this was the only 2 years that the Jewish people celebrated Pesach in different times. The ability of being a leader like Rav Saadia Gaon impressed to no end Rosh HaGalut. He wanted a person like this to be in Surah, and he was absolutely right. In 2 years, Surah became a magnet to all the brilliant students of the Jewish people, and they started to come in their hundreds to Surah, and they renewed the yeshiva. We have no time, unfortunately. No. We will have to do it like Perek Bet, because we did not even start to sing the praises of Saadia Gaon. We just finished the... Okay, so what changes is following? You know what? No connection to Toronto, but I want to talk about what happened in the Muslim world. As I said, the Muslim world, on his conquering the West, Europe, etc., they developed something very, very important, the whole, I would say, financial world. You know, the word check that we use today, okay, everything is wired, but the check, it's an Arab word. The Arabs, who had their base in Yemen, in Saudi Arabia, and made their way to Iran, to Afghanistan, to Turkey, they needed a reliable system of like, okay, I'm going to carry this money. What am I going to do with this money, with all these like robbers on my way? They started to invent the banking system. It was possible that you have like your base in Yemen, you are going to Syria, and for the money you got for your, whatever it was, what they sold, you could deposit it in a bank in Syria, getting a check, and to redeem it in Spain. Now, to us, it's so simple. You get like from your employer, and you go to the bank somewhere, and you get the money. This was such an innovation at the time that enabled people to move freely from one place to another, not worrying about the money. And when people travel, they're exposed to new cultures. They're exposed to new ideas. And therefore, the Arabs, who were at the time a nation of traders, and what traders? They connected Europe and Asia and Africa in a magnificent way. They were exposed to so many cultures, and they started to establish schools, because you cannot be an effective trader if you don't know the languages of the people that you are going to trade with, right? So they taught languages, and they taught finances. They were the first one to introduce to the world credit. Like, you can buy something, and it's okay, don't worry. In 2 months, when I'm coming to visit you, you will pay me, or you deposit the check in the bank in Damascus or Haleb or wherever it is, and people felt very secure. By the way, for the Jews, it was a dream, because the Jews were really the people who could move from one community to another freely. They had a shul, hachnasat orchim. They could travel to communities, and we know so much about communities in this time from the Jewish traders. They prospered when the Muslim prospered, because they helped them to develop. This is a time, by the way, I'll give you one example. Chabal that we don't have enough time. You know, you went to the Metropolitan, you went to museums, you see many pictures of the Christian, crucifying Jesus and all this. You don't see pictures in the Jewish world, right? And not in the Muslim world. You know why? Did you ever think about it? Why there are so many pictures about Miriam and Jesus and all the stories? The reason is very simple. At this time, 10% of the population in Europe could read. So how do you tell them the stories of the Bible? You need pictures. And therefore, the churches are full with pictures. Don't be impressed with this art. This art shows a high level of illiteracy. In the Jewish people, they could read. Children in the age of 7, 8 could read something that most of the population around them, they couldn't. By the Muslim, so in the Jewish community, it was 90%. We have documentation of the 9th and the 10th century, 90% of the people who were sitting in the city, sorry, not in the rural areas, but in the cities, 90% of them, boys and girls, by the way, knew how to read. It was important for tefillah, for other things. Muslim world, about 50%, which is amazing. Compare it like to the scholars of Europe. In Europe, some of the priests could not read. It was the monks who was like the important layer of scholarship. So what happened later? Why we have this decay in the Muslim culture? The Muslims were replaced by the Mamluks, who accepted, I'm not going to explain the difference between the two, but they were attracted to the fields, to the land. A culture that based its wealth on real estate protects the real estate. They don't like to move from one place to another. They stay in the same place to protect the land, to protect their fields, the achuzot, the estates. You stop moving, you stop being cultured. The European from the 13th, 14th century do exactly what the Muslim did 500 years before them. It's just changing. They develop technology, textile. They develop the printing. What is more important than that? The printing. And they start to initiate technology, ideas that enrich the Europeans to become what later become even more sophisticated. And the Muslims who start to be attached to the land, going backwards. So when, for example, ISIS are talking about the caliphate, they're talking about lands, you know that they saying basically, we want to stay primitive. Because the whole revolution of Islam in the 8th and the 9th century was away from the lands, trading, financing, exposing to new ideas. If you are not exposed to new ideas, you are dead. That's what happened to the yeshivot in Babel, as I explained. They died. What was the revolution of Rabbi Saadia Gaon? We will keep it to the next time. So this was basically introduction. Background to the real, to the main shiur. Because let me tell you one thing, like, if we have to have, like, the five most influential people in Jewish history, there is no question that Rav Saadia Gaon is one of them. We would not be here without the innovating thinking of Rabbi Saadia Gaon. Unfortunately, we did not have time, which is good. Okay. Yeah.